All right, so after all the Black Friday shopping and to prepare for Cyber Monday, we're going to talk about treasures in heaven and not laying them up on earth and stuff like that. So it was very fitting for us to talk about this. As we look at this section in the Sermon on the Mount, you could say that verses 19 through 24 are sort of one section, and then 25 through 34 are another section. They're very closely tied together, though, and we'll see that as we go through this text this morning. Let's just remind ourselves of a few things, though, as we look at this. Remember that there's five times in the Gospel of Matthew where you'll see the phrase that goes something like, when he finished these sayings. It happens after the Sermon on the Mount, after the instructions in chapter 10 on evangelism, after the parable chapter in Matthew 13. Remember that in Matthew, the parables are mainly lumped together in chapter 13. There's a couple others in other places. In the Gospel of Luke, they're spread all over the place. But then in Matthew 18, you've got Jesus talking about kingdom relationships and forgiving one another and how to embrace new Christians and stuff like that. And then Matthew 24 and 25 talk about the dominance of the kingdom, how Jerusalem's going to be destroyed, and then ultimately final judgment day in chapter 25 and how Jesus' kingdom is going to have the final say. And so remember that the Gospel of Matthew is written to what audience? Jewish people. How do we know that, by the way? That's one of those things that's like said a lot, but how do we know that? What was that?
The lineage.
Okay, good. So the lineage. So for example, a couple months before I became a Christian, I didn't know anything about the Bible, and the Gideon people handed out the New Testament that starts with Matthew. And I'll never forget trying to read the lineage, and I was so discouraged, and it confirmed to me that I could never know anything about the Bible, because I didn't know any of the background to any of it. The Jews would have known all of that background, though. And all throughout the Gospel of Matthew, he keeps saying, to fulfill this passage, to fulfill that passage. If you're a Gentile who doesn't know the Old Testament, none of that's going to make very much sense to you, so perhaps that's an indicator that it's written to Jewish people. And so the Jewish people would have remembered Moses. What did Moses predict in Deuteronomy? Who would come, and that somebody would come and be like Moses, right?
Right.
How many books of the Bible did Moses write? Five. How many blocks of teaching does Jesus have? Five. He's being presented, I think, as the new Moses. The Sermon on the Mount is presented from a mountain. That's where Moses gave the law, all of those different kinds of parallels. All right. One of the things that I mentioned last class is that I've been wanting to do some word searches on seeing the things that the Pharisees loved. And this is what I had found so far. I guess I don't know that I can fully make a sermon out of it yet in my early research. But a couple things that the Bible says that the Pharisees love. Woe to you, Pharisees, for you love the best seat in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces. They love it when people acknowledge who they are and what they've done and their piety and stuff like that. A little bit later in Luke, it says the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, heard the parable that Jesus just taught, and they ridiculed him. All right, I bring this up because in Matthew chapter 6, I think he's been talking about hindrances to spiritual growth. And the first hindrance that he brings up is pride in verses 1 through 18, which is where you're doing all of these good deeds for what reason? To be seen by men. That kind of fits the first thing that they love here. They love the best seat and the greetings and everything like that. Now, the second hindrance that we're looking at today is materialism. And guess what else they loved? Money. And so these things that he's confronting in chapter 6 would have slapped the Pharisees directly in the face, because these are dealing with things that they loved, and Jesus is trying to shift their love from the praise of men to the praise of God. And he's trying to shift their love of money to the love of treasures in heaven. Maybe he's not addressing them directly, but at least he's confronting the things that they would have loved in this chapter. Any comments or questions just about that? By way of introduction. All right, I want to start out then with this this discussion question here. Because this text is going to deal with the idea of greed from a couple different angles. How do you measure greed in your life? It's not like sexual immorality, where it's really easy to know if that happened, or other sins like words that tear people down. It's really easy to know when that happens. How do you measure greed?
By your checkbook.
Okay, good. You look at your checkbook, the things that you spend. A lot of people don't have checkbooks anymore.
What you give them
more. Right, yeah, that's right.
Based on how satisfied you are with what you have.
Okay, good. How satisfied are you with what you have? What else?
How much time you spend thinking about other things that you need.
Okay, good. What are the things that we think about? This is going to be a lot of what this text deals with. What else? If you what?
How would you feel if everything that you had went away?
Okay, good. What are the things that you're scared to lose? What would it be like for you if everything was lost? Would it destroy your sense of meaning and purpose in life? Things like that. What else?
What other people have that we don't have.
Okay, and maybe how that makes us feel. Okay. So are we jealous of what other people have? Are we always thinking that we should have a better life than we do have? All of those different kinds of things. I believe in 1 Corinthians 5 that one of the things that a church is supposed to exercise discipline on is somebody who's greedy or covetous. How do you know that, though? This is a hard thing. It's one of those things that you can't scientifically measure this, but in some cases you just sort of know it when you see it. But Jesus talked about wealth more than he talked about sexual sin, more than he talked about, I think even more than he talked about hell. And when it comes to things like money and greed, these are one of those things that you're not going to, if you're going to confess them to somebody, this is one of the last things that people are going to confess. Oh yeah, I'm really greedy. Have you ever heard anybody confess that before? Money has a way of blinding us. Greed has a way of blinding us. And so this discussion requires a lot of self-honesty and trying to analyze what's really in our heart. And so that's what we're going to be talking about. Here's the outline of this section here. Verses 19 through 24 talk about the earthly versus heavenly treasures. And then 25 through 34 talks about not being anxious. I have more slides for this part, but I plan to go through this quicker. And I only have one slide for this part and have more discussion on that. All right. So who wants to read verses 19 through 24 to get us started? James?
Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money.
All right, so in this text, he talks about two different places that you can have your treasures, and the first place is treasures on earth. Now, let's say that you're laying up all kinds of treasures on earth and you have to build bigger barns like Jesus would give a parable about in Luke and stuff like this. What's the problem with having treasures on earth? And we'll say what it doesn't mean in just a little bit, but what is the problem with having treasures on earth?
They're temporal.
They don't last very long. What are the things that can take treasures away? The thief can, and what else?
Right.
Yeah, moth and rust. Like, you've got this big intimidating thief, but then you've also got this little moth. So big things and small things can take away the things that mean a lot to you. And I think one of the things Jesus wants us to consider here is that if it can be stolen or removed from you against your own will, it makes a weak God. Do you remember when Rachel is running from Laban with Jacob and everything? Do you remember, what is it that Rachel took from Laban? Yeah, the gods. And then she's sitting on them, and she says that she can't move and everything because of the reasons that she gives there. Laban, I think, would hopefully learn from that experience that if my God can be taken away from me, maybe I'm wrapping my heart around things that are going to pull away and then rip my heart open in the process. I think something that should be considered with this is that all of the losses that we experience in life, all of the things that maybe we were tempted to make into some sort of God, all the times that those things pull away from us ought to cultivate a different kind of hope in our hearts. You remember in Romans 5, where he talks about rejoicing in suffering because it creates endurance, and endurance produces, you remember? Patience and hope. Well, how do you get from suffering to hope? Well, if the things in this life keep pulling away from you, the things that you wanted to trust in are just kind of constantly training you, if you have the right heart, to know that I can't put my hope in this life. It's supposed to redirect us to the things that are eternal, which we'll talk about in just a second. But something else to say about this. This can't be a prohibition against storing up things, period. After all, we have a garage back there. Did you guys notice that in the parking lot? So we shouldn't have that, right? And the resource room, we shouldn't have that either. What's the idea? How do we know that this can't be an absolute prohibition against storing up? Okay, good. So you got in the Bible, there are righteous and wealthy people. Are there unrighteous wealthy people too? Okay, are there righteous poor people in the Bible? Are there unrighteous poor people in the Bible? Yeah, so wealth is not the determining factor on whether or not you're going to be righteous, but the Bible does indicate that wealth oftentimes can blind people if they let it do that.
Or you can say, God created physical things.
Yeah, good. In Genesis chapter 1, God creates all the physical things, and then he says it's really bad and we should all be disgusted with it. No. There's nothing inherently wrong with physical things, and in the Bible, we're supposed to enjoy the Creator's gifts. In Proverbs 6, we're supposed to save for our future and learn from the ant that saves up for different seasons and stuff like that. So this is not an absolute prohibition. So how do we know then if we're storing up wealth? Because how many of you have a 401k? I don't have one, so I guess I'm good, right? Like, how do you know if this is not an absolute prohibition and we are storing up something? How do we know if we're actually doing what Jesus says to not do here? You see what I'm saying here? Because it would be easy to say, if you guys have savings accounts, you are committing a sin. But we know that that can't be true. So how do we know if we're storing up treasures on earth?
You have to look at your heart. And yeah. What is in your heart? Why are you doing it? How much are you going to?
Good. So, again, it requires a lot of self-honesty, self-reflection. Anything else you guys would say? But this is, a hard thing to measure.
Well, the parable of the talents is all about, you know, storing up wealth and making good use of your wealth and, you know, and primarily what's in your heart as what you do with it.
Okay, good.
Any other? Saving in such a way that you're neglecting to be giving.
Okay, good. Yeah, in your saving, are you thinking to yourself, all right, when I get to a certain point financially, then I'll start giving? Well, what happens if that's the way that you think, and then you get to that financial point, then what happens?
You want to go further.
You want to go a little bit further. Well, I know what I said, but if your saving right now is preventing you from giving to anybody else right now, then that's an indicator that you're self-deceived and maybe blinded. Anything else about that?
So earlier, the difficult to assess motive. Now, we've seen this already in the sermon.
Yeah.
On spiritual or love of God, other things. And why are we doing worship? I think was a long discussion about how, you know, can I not do anything in public? Mm-hmm. And then if I do, how do I know? I think it has to be measured on some kinds of actions, because I don't think we're that good at looking at our hearts. I mean, I understand what Nanette's saying. Maybe you can see what you think about all the time, but at some point you got to step out and say, well, there was a deep need. I didn't even participate.
Sure.
Or something like that.
Right.
There's got to be some measured actions which sets us apart from the world, but then we're measuring the wrong standard. You know what I mean? But it is an action.
Right. So in addition to, part of this is, I have to be as honest with myself as I can be. I also need to be in community with people who can see my blind spots and let people say things about me that might be hard to hear. But also, is there any tangible thing that I've done for people?
Right. Without other motives.
Right.
Confused issue.
Right. Right. All right. So we'll come back around to some of this. Notice what he says, though, about the treasures in heaven. What does he say about the nature of storing treasures in heaven? what can't happen to them?
Well, they're permanent.
They're permanent.
Secure.
All right. So
is the opposite, you know, one thing we talk about security. So maybe one thing, if we placed our security in our wealth, in these things, is that where we're secure? Do you really feel secure in those? Because if they're gone, then what happens to you? I know you mentioned that before.
Right.
So is that where your security is? It's not just that, but is that where you, is that your identity and these other things that you may have placed in these things? So if they're not here, you feel you're not happy. You feel less than, you feel all these other things. Are those the motivation for who you are?
Right. Very good. When I was in California, the cost of land was insane. And there is some people that I got to know out there that would say, well, the best investment you can make is property. The best investment, so you got to buy some property. You have to buy property in California, and then you're going to make a lot of money. All right, what's more secure? What's the wisest investment you can make? Yeah, and putting treasures in heaven. There's people that, I don't know, what is it that they put in Switzerland? Is it gold in the mountains there? Is that what... Does anybody have a Switzerland account? I think people store like wealth in these mountains in Switzerland. That, you know, they're always like kind of the neutral nation, so nobody's ever going to take it. Ultimately, what's going to happen to those mountains?
They're going to be destroyed.
They're all going to be destroyed. What is the best investment you can make? Is storing up treasures in heaven. Okay, well, so what does that mean, though? Can you guys think of some examples of storing up treasures in heaven?
Well, being that none of us have actually been there, but it can be hard to describe streets of gold and such, and rivers of life, and trees that bear fruit of all kinds every month of the year. I mean, that's about it.
I think it's what you're doing while you're here.
Yeah.
Are you? What Christ said, you know, what you're doing for others, those are treasures.
Okay, good. And notice here that he is talking about wealth. How are there ways that you can use your money to expand the kingdom of God, to help aid in the expansion of the kingdom of God? Does it cost money to be hospitable? Okay, is that a good investment, though?
Sure.
Evidently it is. So is, with the kingdom economics... The best investments is when you're not necessarily storing up everything because you think you need this for your sense of security. The ultimate investment is investing in the kingdom, and that will pay greater dividends than anything else that you could try to invest in. Not that it's, again, a blanket statement that you can't have a 401k and all those different kinds of things. But how do you use your money? Are you using it to build relationships, not so that you can have business connections or something like that, but because you really love people? Are you supporting evangelism in one way or another, however that applies to finances? Are you engaged in those kinds of things? Is there tangible stuff that you can look at if you're questioning if you are this kind of person and say, well, I have done that. Maybe it is an indicator, but then you can't let your right hand know what your left hand is doing, so you've got to be careful and all of that sort of thing. But I don't know if that helps us at all, but anything else you guys want to say about that?
Kind of also be a metaphor. I'm going off. She said, we're just in general preparing yourself for heaven because technically it's already built. You can't really contribute anything to
right. The
design and the nature of heaven that God already has. But it's just more of a metaphor for doing things down here in preparation and knowing that you are going there.
Right. Maybe. I think that's part of it. I think the overall idea is what is your focus and where is your heart? But what is it in this room that we get to take to heaven with us?
Our souls.
Our souls. And one another, right? So like the people that we're helping influence and stuff like that, are we engaged in the lives of other people to help them be there one day? So it's all of those different kinds of things, I think, put together. And if you're focused on these things, you won't be focused on these things. And he's going to talk about not serving two masters in just a second. All right. Just say this, talk about this briefly in verse 21, where he says, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. He's saying here that whatever you put your treasure in, whatever your treasure is, your heart's going to be connected to it. So think again. If let's say that you treasured something that a moth destroyed. Do you really treasure something that's that weak that you're going to allow a moth to destroy your heart? Or a thief to destroy your heart? You see how weak that is? So maybe a couple questions then to analyze if our heart is wrapped up in earthly treasure. What do we research the most? What does our library look like? What are the kinds of things that we read? The kind of informational YouTube videos that we watch all the time and stuff like that. In moments that we don't have to do anything else, or we can do a mindless task like doing the dishes or something like that, what are we thinking about? What are the things that our mind naturally gravitates towards? Or what are we most excited to share with other people? I think I'm convinced that everybody has a gospel. Everybody has something that they think is good news that they want other people to know. For some people, it's their diet. For some people, it's their workout. For some people, it's their selfies on Instagram or something like that. What are you most excited to share with other people? And all of those things, I think, help us know if we're if we have earthly or heavenly treasures. All right, anything else you guys want to say about that? All right, let's move then to this middle section about the two eyes. So we've had two treasures. Now we're going to have two different kinds of eyes that you can have. And there, this is kind of tricky to understand exactly what he means by this. There's two main perspectives I think you can have on this, and I think you can make biblical cases for either one. So the first view is this, that the eye represents what we look at. So it's whatever our eye looks at and focuses on is what's coming into us. And so if we're focusing on things that are bad, then that's going to feed us with things that are bad and create a dark kind of person. If you have a bad eye or you're blind, there can be light all around you that's not coming in. And so the person with the bad eye has light available to them, but they're not wanting to take it in. And so maybe that's what he means here. A second view, though, is that the bad eye in the Old Testament means somebody who's stingy, or an evil eye means somebody that is stingy in the Old Testament. Proverbs 23, Deuteronomy 15 talks about a guy with an evil eye. Some of your translations would have to be a footnote that would let you know that in Proverbs 23, for example, that this is actually an evil eye, because I think the word that's used there in the ESV is actually stingy. And so maybe he's saying here that refusing to give to other people in a tangible kind of way indicates that you're full of darkness, because we love, we laid down our life for the brothers because he first did that for us in a tangible way. So therefore, we do it in a tangible way for other people. So what view do you guys think makes the most sense of this?
I think number two, because that's the context of what we're talking about right now.
Right. And earlier he talks about giving alms to people, so you can make a case for that. Anybody want to defend the other view? Can you see how these two views actually get kind of interconnected anyways? Because if you're not giving to other people, it's an indication that the things that you're taking in are self-centered kinds of things anyways. I think you can, both of them are at least true. If the text is trying to indicate one or the other, I'm honestly not sure which one it would be. So, anything else you want to say about that one? All right, let's talk about the two masters, and after that we'll get into the discussion about anxiety and stuff. All right, so he says you can't serve two masters. I think oftentimes when we study verse 24, we immediately get to the metaphorical meaning of it without thinking about the imagery of what he's actually saying to the first century audience. Can you imagine literally having a master that you have to go work in the field and you work 12 hours, and then you have to go to your other master, and he says, all right, I know it's nighttime and everything, but you really need to clean my chicken coop now, and that's going to take all night. Can you imagine doing that? How many of us could actually work two full-time jobs? That's something that you just can't do. And so he says in this text that if you try to serve two masters, if you try to serve God and money, there's going to be two different scenarios, and I'm not sure if these two scenarios are just saying the same things in two different ways, or if there is a difference in both of these. But here's the first scenario. If you try to serve two masters, you're going to hate one and serve the other. Now, do you remember when Jesus would say in Luke 14 that unless you hate your father, mother, brother, sister, wife in your own life, then you can't be my disciple? I don't know that hate here means that you just absolutely want to destroy it, but it means more so that, your love for one is overshadowing the love for the other. Maybe that's what he means here. So he could be saying that you're going to have less affection for one of them, but you're going to faithfully serve the other one. Can you see, like, go to church every week and you look kind of religious and everything like that? But during the week, the thing that we really care about is wealth and amassing our resume and all of these different kinds of things. And so we're not really excited to serve God, and we're not really excited to do what he's asked us to do. And in fact, we have just enough religion to make us a little miserable and frustrated that it's part of our life. But the thing that we're really all about is what's happening the rest of the week. And then we end up making carnal, fleshly excuses to not fully do what God has asked us to do. The other scenario is that you're going to be devoted to one and despise the other. Now, do you think he's saying the same thing, or do you think there's a difference in these two things? And I don't know the answer. What are your guys' thoughts, though? Bad question.
Well, if you don't know, I don't guess we know either.
I mean, to be devoted to one, you're going to abide in the service of one. To despise means to consider lightly. It's not an insipid kind of attitude towards something necessarily. It means to, like, just kind of disregard it, like not take it in the full weight that it ought to be taken. But you can see how this could happen. Somebody can still look religious while trying to serve two masters. We can't think to ourselves that because I come to church three times a week and I even am prepared for Bible class and all of these, and there's this one time a couple of years ago when I helped somebody, that because of that, I'm definitely faithfully serving Jesus. It's one or the other.
It feels like it. So I don't have a good answer either. It feels like a Hebrew couplet.
Yeah.
And it's they're reversed in order. So that could be part of it. But maybe there's a little bit more subtle message, and that is there's a symmetry that you just can't deny.
Yeah.
I think there are some times when you can do one thing which inhibits you from doing another thing, but somehow when you do the other thing, it doesn't inhibit you from doing the other.
Right.
You understand what I mean? He's saying, no, it's fully symmetric.
Right, right.
And
there's no way to marry these two things.
Right.
And yeah.
It isn't like, yeah, but if you're a Christian, you can do everything else, and it works fine.
Right.
If you're a Christian first. And he said, no, it works both ways.
Right.
And the other thing is, I think your point about how often the things that we are neglecting, and maybe know we shouldn't neglect, are sources of anxiety.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. Yes.
You know, that kind of thing. So there is a sense of, I guess serving the other sounds terribly negative to us, but it probably has not the intent of what he's saying there. But we will end up kind of being resentful.
Yes.
Of the thing that we kind of are trying to hold on to again.
So what...
Like the guy that told you to clean the chicken coops, right?
Right. Yeah, you're not going to like... Yeah. So think about your attitude about even, like, coming here this morning. Was it like, I'm excited for the football games today, so I'm just excited to get done with all of this and all that sort of thing, and I know there's going to be a brother or sister that might be in need, and I just hope that they don't ask. You know, what is it that we're most affectionate towards? And I think that's telling where our heart is and what master we're trying to serve. This doesn't mean that you have to give up your secular job, because in your secular job, you incorporate God in how you work. So that's not the point of this either. So that's the earthly and heavenly treasures. Let's see how the next section connects to this. Who wants to read verses 25 to 34 for us? You want to do again, James? You'll be our reader today.
Therefore, I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is it not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? And which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to his span of life? And why are you anxious about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon, in all his glory, was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the fields, which today is alive and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? Therefore, do not be anxious, saying, what shall we eat? Or what shall we drink? Or what shall we wear? For the Gentiles seek after these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them all. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Therefore, do not be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble.
All right. We're probably not going to exhaust, well, we never do anyways, you never can. Let's just start out with this question. What is anxiety? And the ESV uses the word anxiety. That might seem really clinical and something that only psychologists should use that word, but then Christians should use the word worry or something. I don't know. So anxiety, worry, what is it?
Constantly dwelling over a problem.
Okay, good. So you're kind of stewing on something and wondering how it's going to turn out or whatever. What else? Yeah, fear and insecurity, and he talks about this right after he talks about people that would try to build security and wealth. We'll see how those things connect in just a second. The Greek word is meronao, and the idea of it is to be troubled with future cares. You see that in verse 34. Tomorrow is going to be anxious for itself. It's thinking constantly about what's going to happen in the future. Some people have described it as being pulled in different directions. Like there's, I don't know, like you got kids all over you that are pulling on this arm and then on this arm or something, and you're like, I don't know how to deal with this situation, but that's what's happening mentally. Is worry inherently wrong? Is there anything, remember in Philippians 4 where it says, be anxious for nothing? Well, in Philippians 2, Timothy is held up as a good example who is anxious about God's things. And so it's interesting that at the end of the book of Philippians, he says, it's the same Greek word, by the way, be anxious for nothing, but Timothy's held up as a good example of somebody who has the right kind of worry. So this isn't necessarily an inherently wrong emotion and feeling, because should we be at times, should we be more worried about our spiritual health if we're spiritually unhealthy? Concern drives us to do something about things. So this is not inherently wrong. The problem is what do we become anxious about? Something else to say about the nature of anxiety is seen in how we speak. In verse 31, there's three times in this text where he says, do not be anxious, do not be anxious, do not be anxious. But in verse 31, he ties it to things that we actually say. So in verse 31, therefore do not be anxious. Okay, well, how do we know if we are? Saying, what shall we eat? What shall we drink? What shall we wear? How will we pay the mortgage this month? How will we... sometimes conversations have to happen, but what's the tenor of our heart as we have those conversations is the question. And so it's seen in how we speak. All right, how much time do we have? Okay, I want to break up into groups or whatever. Just talk to the person next to you or whatever, and try to think about this question: what are the sources of anxiety? And try to answer it only from this text, only from this text. What are the sources of anxiety? So I'll give you guys like 3 minutes to talk to one another and try to figure that out together. Discuss those. All right. What do you guys find? What are the sources? I found two of them. You guys can probably help add to my list. So what did you guys find as sources of anxiety in this text?
Money.
Okay, how so?
Putting trust in the money and treasure and becoming pure earth as opposed to... But that's not the section we're in.
Okay, but notice, what's the first word in verse 25?
Therefore.
Yeah.
This is drawing a conclusion from what was just talked about. Mm-hmm. Don't serve two masters, have a good eye, put your treasures in heaven. Therefore, don't worry. So, I think part of what he's saying here is that when we worry... it might be an indicator that we are trying to serve two masters, because if I'm trying to serve two masters, guess what's going to happen? I will be pulled in different directions, because I feel like I have to serve this one and serve that one, and then I will end up starting to despise this, and as I'm trying to give a little bit of attention to that, I'm starting to worry about what's going to happen over here. I'm not single-focused on anything. And so I think money or trying to serve two masters is one source of anxiety. And think about that in your own life. The times that you've really and I know that there people have like clinical anxiety problems, and that's not what we're talking about right now, but people that just are constant worriers, in your own life, and be honest about it, the times that you've worried the most, is it when you've tried to serve two masters? And I think this text is saying, yes, that's true. We just have to see how that works in our life. So good. That's one source of anxiety, I think. What other sources of anxiety do you see here?
Your basic needs. You know, food, clothes, you know, worried about where that's going to be.
Okay, good. Good. What else? It's really easy to miss in verse 30.
God's care for us.
God's care for us. And what's the little jab almost that Jesus says about people that are worrying? All right, so where does worry come from? Lacking faith. Really? So that means that if I'm like, if I can't go to sleep that night because I'm constantly worrying and all of these different kinds of things, sometimes that's legitimate, sometimes worrying is good because of Philippians 2 and stuff like that. But if it's the wrong kind of worry, and it's causing me all kinds of turmoil and stuff like that, is it possible that it's because I don't have the kind of faith that I ought to have? Well, that's what the text is saying. Maybe something you can say about anxiety or worry then is that when I have an overconfidence in how I think the future ought to go, that's oftentimes when I'll be worried about something. When I think I know how it ought to go, then I'm going to try to move all the chess pieces in the right way to make that happen, and that's going to create a lot of other kind of stress and stuff. The alternative is to trust in God, and we'll talk about that in just a second. But did you guys find any other sources of worry, Nanette?
I was thinking of, you know, he clothes the grass of the field, which today is, tomorrow is thrown into the oven. You know, they would use it for bread. So we're more concerned about our life here than what is in heaven. We may not have a life tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right. That's
it
good.
May be thrown in the oven.
So maybe the ultimate future we should be concerned about is being with God forever.
Right.
So, good.
I don't know if this is what you said, verse 30, but is it the one of the things is about anxiety is the ability about things we can't control.
Yes.
So when we're talking about tomorrow, you're actually suggesting that someone owes you tomorrow.
Right.
God doesn't even owe you tomorrow. So deal with today. And then if he's gracious enough to grant you a tomorrow, it'll be today.
Right.
And you deal with it today.
I remember when I was leaving the training program with Barry Kirchville, and I had been preaching in the training program 2 times a month, and I told Barry, I'm going to be preaching 8 to 10 times a month in California. Like, how, and I'm doing all the Bible classes, and I'm doing all the evangelism. Like, how am I going to do all that? And he said, well, on Monday, can you do what you can do on Monday and work a little bit on your sermons and do some evangelism? I said, well, yeah, I could do that. He's like, okay, when it's Tuesday, can you do whatever you can do on Tuesday? And I said, yeah, I can do that. I was like, this is going to be easy, you know? and it wasn't. all right, so the sources of anxiety, there's probably more we could say about that, but I want to talk about this really quick, how to overcome anxiety. One thing Jesus says here is to meditate or think deeply about a couple things. Note, for example, in verse 27 that when you worry, it's wasted energy. It can't add a single span to your days. It's not going to prolong your days. In fact, you might get a heart attack because of it. And so it's completely wasted energy. That's not something that you want to focus on in that way. And then also consider the lesser things like the birds and the lilies and of how those are less important in the eyes of God than you are. Look around, like go outside and look at the birds, just watch them. And then let that calm me down a little bit. Notice here though, the world will tell you that if you want to overcome worry, what you have to do is you have to clear your mind and just think nothing or whatever. That's one approach to dealing with anxiety. Notice what Jesus says to do though. He says you need to fill your mind with the right thing. You need to fill your mind with the right way of looking at things. This is not about clearing your mind. Maybe clearing your mind of the bad things you're thinking, but you need to proactively fill it with the right way of thinking about stuff. So that's one thing that it says there. Notice something else, though. Proactively have a focus on the kingdom of God in verse 33, and in that process, shift your trust, your overconfidence that you think you know how things ought to go, and focus on God in trust that He'll give you the things that you need. Alright, so everybody should just stop worrying now because we talked about this, right? This stuff has to be like worked into our hearts as we constantly proactively force ourselves to think about this in the moments that we're steering off the road. And so, I don't know if anybody has anything else they want to add to that.
We can add, I was just thinking about not only the future, but how about the past as well?
Sure, yeah.
Things that have happened is like you can't, there's no go back machine that you can go,
right.
And you sit there and toil and twist about things that, and there's nothing you can do, and you will wear yourself out about those things.
Yep. That's good. Anything else you want to say about that? Do you notice how worry is a mental thing, right? Like it happens in the mind. And so it makes sense that you have to put off one way of thinking and then put on another way of thinking. And if you do that, it'll start to affect your emotions. So you've got a thinking aspect to it, and then you've got a tangible aspect to it. And as you put those things together, then hopefully it starts to dissipate and we start to have a greater trust in God and stuff like that. So, anything else you guys want to say about that? All right, then we're done.